AIDS World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people. Everywhere you go, you always take the weather with you. Everywhere you go, you always take the weather. Everywhere you go, you always take the weather with you. Everywhere you go, you always take the weather. You take the weather with you.
This is Wade Rathke. That means it's Wade's World. It's Friday morning. Hello, Friday, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time. We're broadcasting at KABF 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power, broadcasting from our studios in Little Rock, Arkansas, live streamed at www.kabf.org. And with any luck, by this weekend, the podcast will be on our website at www.kabf.org/Wade's World, and you'll be able to hear this if you missed any part of it. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Professor Adam Seth Levine, professor at Cornell University, and that's not why we're talking to him. We're talking to him about a fascinating bunch of research that he's developed into a book called American Insecurity. How we, and then there's a whole subtitle. What is that subtitle, Adam? Tell people.
Why Our Economic Fears Lead to Political Inaction.
And he's saying inaction, which is part of what caught my attention. How our economic fears lead to political inaction. So, Adam, what in the world? This is a topic that anybody who's involved in politics or community or labor organizing or just about anything needs to understand, at least in my book. And I read your book. I can't remember how I found it, but it just was published recently, right?
Yep, just published in January.
Okay, they're still in the snow belt in Ithaca, New York, but obviously it warmed up enough for us to get it on Kindle, so you have a very interesting phrase that you repeat consistently through the book about, and it took me a while to learn it. It didn't, flow quickly on my tongue, but self-undermining rhetoric. Well, what in the world, Adam? What is that, Professor?
Yeah, so in the book I developed this concept of self-undermining rhetoric, and what it refers to is political rhetoric that reminds people of different kinds of thoughts that actually undermine the very purpose that that rhetoric is trying to achieve. And so you can think about, for example, a historical example completely unrelated to the content of the book would be things like Christine O'Donnell running for the Senate and saying things like she was the person who had the history in witchcraft. Saying things like, I am not a witch, and trying to get people to not evaluate her as a witch. But the problem is that when you say things like that, you actually bring to mind thoughts about whether or not she might be a witch.
Exactly right. I can give you some more true life examples, too.
Yeah. Richard Nixon saying, I'm not a crook. Again, you sort of, leads people to evaluate, well, wait a minute, is he a crook? Is he not a crook? And things like that. And, of course, those aren't examples in the book, but just general ideas where you're bringing to mind considerations that actually are undermining what you're trying to do.
One of the things that, I've got to be honest, I've been an organizer a long time, but it's a mistake I'm sure I've made sometimes on the doors and with people, and I know many others have, but one of the things that sort of, caught me in the book is how sometimes telling people an organization's victories can actually send the self-undermining message that, hey, maybe I don't have to get involved. Maybe they don't need me. They're winning without me. Tell me about that. How did you come to that? That one was a wake-up call for me and I hope many.
Yeah, so one of the findings that I actually don't develop too much in the book, but actually is in a separate separate stream of research, is this idea that when organizations are trying to get new people involved, they could either focus on what they've accomplished in the past, which is potentially really good for establishing credibility, especially if you're trying to reach out to new people, or you can focus on what your goals are for the future. And in reality, both organizations are typically trying to do a mixture of both. But one of the things I find is that when you focus on to the extent you focus on things that the organization has done in the past, what you're essentially communicating to people who aren't already involved with the organization is, look, we have all these great successes, and we've basically done it without you. And so instead, information that focuses on what the organization wants to do in the future is far more persuasive from a mobilizing point of view. And I really should stress that actually all of that refers to people who aren't currently donors or activists.
Right. We're talking about recruitment, but, hey, you know, none of us are as big as we need to be, so recruitment's important in all these kinds of endeavors. Now, how did you – it sounds right to me, obviously, but it's not this is not just a philosophical book. You actually did a fair amount of field tests with some interesting organizations to come to some of these conclusions. Am I correct?
Yeah, no, that's right. And so, you know, a lot of what the book focuses on is, you know, how it is you might mobilize people, or what rhetoric about economic insecurity issues. So things like healthcare costs or college costs, retirement insecurity, threat of unemployment, actual unemployment, things like that. What that kind of rhetoric, what comes to mind when organizations and activists talk about that kind of rhetoric? And so what I have in the book are a number of different sort of both experiments as well as survey data in which I've sort of, you know, looked at, you know, what happens when people receive that kind of rhetoric. And it turns out that there are many circumstances under which receiving that kind of rhetoric can actually sort of diminish people's willingness to get involved.
But you also found with some organizations that different rhetoric might inspire donations versus volunteer activity. That was a fascinating but complicated kind of notion, but it's very important, obviously, in any organization's life.
Yeah, so the self-undermining rhetoric, the way that it works in the book is that, largely in the book, is that when you're mobilizing people around issues that pertain to financial constraints that they might be facing, and these are issues that they might care a lot about, and we have a lot of evidence that people, when you ask them, you know, should the government be involved with trying to reduce, say, retirement insecurity or job insecurity or healthcare insecurity? Overwhelming proportions of people say yes. And this is true across the political spectrum. And so there's sort of, you know, from an attitudinal point of view, there's definitely sort of, you know, room for that, room for sort of, you know, political action that's based on that and mobilizing based on that. But what I find is that when you remind people about issues, when you mention issues that remind people about their financial constraints, it reduces their willingness to spend money, and then if they're in the labor force, it also reduces their willingness to spend time on politics. And so, as you said earlier, I do have a number of different studies with a number of different organizations where that's exactly what we've done, is we've given people different kinds of sort of, you know, language and seen that, indeed, it can reduce their willingness to spend money, and if they're in the labor force, they're willing to spend time.
Well, and that's important because it also helps explain part of this divide we have between political donors and political activists as well. I mean, more and more money's come into politics, but how to get more people. This may be, you know, part of the message here is how to exactly craft that message.
I think that's exactly right. One of the things I mentioned at the very beginning of the book is I recognize that a lot of people might pick up a book like this and say, to what extent does any of this stuff matter at all? And I think it's really important to say, you know, any of this stuff in the sense of, you know, individuals who might be donating as much time as they can or, you know, as much money and chipping in a few dollars or things like that. And I think the one thing to, you know, a couple of things are really important on that point. One is that we hear many people over and over again saying that's exactly what we need people to do. And I take those kinds of calls to action very seriously. But then the second thing is that we have really good examples where when large numbers of people are organized and chipping in a few dollars and or spending, you know, a bit of time, as much time as they can, you know, they really can affect change. And that is true even certainly on, you know, the local and state levels, but even on the national level. But I think, you know, one thing that you mentioned before, you know, it's worth underscoring that what I find in a lot of my studies is that it's the people who do care about the issues for a variety of reasons, but aren't personally affected. Because for them, they're the ones who might receive this kind of insecurity-related rhetoric, but aren't reminded of a personal financial constraint. They're the ones who can be most easily mobilized.
And a lot of people would find that contradictory, wouldn't they, Adam?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it's important to sort of situate everything I'm talking about in terms of kind of this conventional, very intuitive idea that's out there and actually has a lot of previous work to recommend it, which is that caring about an issue, finding an issue to be important, ought to motivate you to get involved, like that in and of itself. And a lot of what I'm talking about here is that, you know, for some people that might totally be the case, but for other people it might not be, depending upon what kinds of considerations the rhetoric brings to mind, essentially if the rhetoric is, as I call it, self-undermining or not.
As a organizer, even back to my earliest days founding ACORN, one of the things that, you know, I was, this was the 1970, 71, 72, and the dominant political philosophy was the Saul Alinsky notion that self-interest is what moved everyone. Yet, when you were actually in the streets organizing people, as I was originally in Little Rock and elsewhere, you had to look sometimes at who actually came to the meeting or became leaders and how, in fact, self-interest was way down the list of what was actually moving them. They might be your best people arguing for more educational benefits or better housing rights or, you know, justice on certain issues. And it was outside their personal experience. It was a community interest. It was aspirational. It was based on their expectations of self. But self-interest just didn't explain it. And that's part of what resonated in my reading of your book is that, hey, that's not unusual. That's just not me being an outlier. Maybe there's actually some evidence I can find to back up that, you know, now 45-year-old experience.
No, I think that's exactly right. And what you're describing is not at all an outlier. In fact, what I would argue is perfectly consistent with all of the attributes of human psychology that I'm talking about in the book. And the role of self-interest is so, you know, it's so interesting. Pardon the, you know, the use of that word.
Hey, it's okay on Wade's World. This isn't the classroom. We're pretty wide on the waterfront here.
You know, because you know, what I'm talking about in the book is that, you know, and we, you know, in political science and politics, you know, and I'm sure, you know, you talked about this as well, you know, in your organizing, that, you know, the role of self-interest, on the one hand, it seems like such an obvious point. Of course self-interest is going to motivate people to get involved. But yet actually, you know, I think the role of self-interest is more sort of, you know, just as you're describing, is potentially far more sort of complicated and nuanced. And so, for example, what I have in the book is that self-interest might motivate people, and I have some data for this, might motivate people to think that a problem is important. So the people who are most likely to be unable to pay their health care bills are those who are most likely to also say health care is the most important problem facing the country, for example. And that's a question about, you know, what people think the political agenda should look like, or priority should look like. But yet that same self-interest, that same reason for thinking it should be at the top of the political agenda is precisely the reason why you won't necessarily spend your money or time becoming active on it.
Well, let's dig down on that. We're talking to Professor Adam Seth Levine of Cornell, who's written a fascinating and, in my view, important book called American Insecurity and How Economic Arguments Can Lead to Inaction. We're talking about healthcare because that's one of the issues and groupings of people he looked at closely. The affordable care recruitment effort a year ago, interesting how they tried to message that, particularly on the issue of penalties, what the penalties were if you didn't sign up. And it wasn't until the very end of the enrollment campaign that the CMS website and the navigators and others even started talking about, hey, maybe you better sign up because you're going to pay this penalty and this year if you're not a part of it. Did you look at, how would you analyze some of the various attempts of the Obama administration to get people to enroll last year compared to this year, or just in general? Did you notice any of that?
One of the things that I do focus on actually quite a bit is certainly the politics of healthcare in recent years and the politics, especially leading up to the Affordable Care Act. In fact, this is a really sort of fascinating example because it's true that what I'm about to say is not from the past year, but I figure given that we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, it's worth kind of mentioning.
Exactly.
What I looked at starting in especially 2008 and certainly 2009 into 2010, the work of Healthcare for America Now, HCAN.
Exactly.
And in that organization was, you know, one of the major, the major progressive coalition that was sort of, you know, behind the idea of healthcare reform. And Healthcare for America Now was, in a lot of ways, was extremely successful, especially at kind of keeping Congress's feet to the fire. I mean, they had people sort of, you know, in House districts, you know, around the country, making sure that when the going got tough, you know, both the House and the Senate were sort of, you know, were moving forward with healthcare reform.
Well, and ACORN, just as full disclosure, was part of the HKN coalition for a number of years. So, yeah, we were part of those people in those districts, let's say.
So you certainly know about this, and it's and you know it's and so you know HKN was extremely successful in lots and lots of ways, and but what's interesting is that when I read Sir Richard Kirsch, who was the head of ACORN, he published a book a couple of years ago. And I had the opportunity to sort of talk to him as well as sort of talk to the other people involved with HKN, particularly on kind of the organizing side. And one of the things that they told me, which I thought was really interesting, was that when they looked at sort of, you know, who their membership was in March of 2010 when Obama signed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, one of the interesting things was that most of their members were middle-class, upper-middle-class professionals. And so what that means is that most of them were the set of people who arguably, you know, stood to gain the least from the Affordable Care Act. Not to say that they wouldn't potentially benefit, certainly if they, you know, lost their jobs, but, you know, on average, they sort of stood to gain the least. And this is very consistent with exactly what you were saying a few minutes ago about the kinds of people that you saw in your work who were most active and how self-interest didn't really seem to be a primary driver. And I would argue that's exactly what's going on here as well.
But wasn't that also the, you know, expansive critique of the administration's inability, starting in 2010, to fully explain and sell, if you will, the advantages of the Affordable Care Act to the public at large?
Well, yeah,
something wasn't right about their messaging. I'm not sure they were swallowing the ask, as we say, or subverting their own message, in your language, you know, self-undermining their rhetoric, but something they were saying was not communicating to enough people the benefits of the program. And I'm not sure what mistakes they were making. I'm wondering if you have a thought.
I do think that's sort of that it's interesting to kind of, you know, juxtapose both of those points at the same time. And so on the one hand, you sort of, you need to have a message that actually resonates with people. And to the extent that it speaks to their personal experience, that can be, on the one hand, an extremely effective message. That's a way to sort of, you know, get them involved, get them to pay attention, get them to sort of to pay attention to something that, you know, to pay attention to politics where politics might not otherwise potentially be a part of their everyday lives because they have so many other work and family and personal commitments. And then on the other hand, a lot of what we're talking about here is essentially what you want people to do. So once you've sort of gotten their attention and potentially had a message that have a message that resonates with them, then what are you actually asking them to do? Are you asking them to change their minds, you know, to support whatever you're talking about or, you know, believe that it's a priority or so on and so forth? And or are you trying to get them to spend scarce resources of money and time expressing those opinions, expressing their minds? And so I think it's really interesting at how you need to really have both. And I think there's, you know, a lot of the, you know, one aspect of a message being self-undermining or swallowing the ask, as you said, is when you essentially remind people about financial constraints via then ask them to spend money or time. Another potential way of swallowing the ask is essentially not giving people a clear message as to what's in it for them. And one of the things that I seem to observe with the language about around the Affordable Care Act a lot was exactly that. The other thing, too, I should say, is that, you know, it's easy. There's some really fascinating work on health, the debate over health care reform back in the 90s, looking at how when you're proposing change, your job is just so much harder because you need to not only convince people that the status quo is a problem, but that whatever you're proposing is the way to go instead. Whereas people who don't necessarily agree with you can basically just scare people about whatever it is that you're talking about and get people to say, you know what, maybe the status quo isn't so bad.
Well, and we find that in union organizing all the time, that in a lot of ways what you're running against is the devil they know versus the devil they don't. And
exactly.
To the degree that company messaging is always about the uncertainty and what you don't know about the union and whatever, you're really, you know, in a communications battle, as you would term it, Professor, about trying to convince people that, without being totally negative, that, in fact, the devil they know is much worse. Because you can't guarantee anything, and that's part of the problem, and that's obviously what the company rhetoric relies on, too, is that, you know, you win an election, you get to collectively bargain, everything is up for grabs. There's no, you know, surety in that regime, and that's part of why I think unions, you know, have been falling like a rock, is that we don't have a majoritarian message that allows us to build a different realization on what an organization can accomplish in these contexts. It's a problem.
Yeah, one of the things, actually just to slightly return back to the example from the healthcare reform debate in the 90s, in the early 90s, one of the most fascinating studies I've read about, you know, that's really tried to analyze what happened and how it is that sort of public opinion shifted the way it did and so on and so forth, you know, echoes exactly the sentiment that you just described. This idea essentially that the people who were in favor of change, you know, they were trying to basically, they had two jobs at once. And then other people who were opposed to change had one job, essentially. And the goal, or rather the sort of, the psychologists give a fancy name to this. They call it status quo bias. But it really gets at this idea that sort of, you know, yeah, the devil that you don't know is worse than the devil you do know.
Well, I mean, in organizing, we've always known it's much easier to attack something than it is to build something. I was talking via Skype to a class at the University of Memphis yesterday, and this is one of the questions one of the seminar participants, you know, ask is, well, is organizing always reactive or is it ever proactive? Whoa, easy, son. You're wrong for that. I've got a, we're talking to Professor Levine at Cornell about a very interesting way of looking at, or sort of a wake-up call about the impact of our messaging as we organize and talk politically and try to get a full and vibrant democratic level of participation by people. And sometimes we're stepping on our own toes as we try to walk forward. I've got to share a story with you from... I left Acorn at 2008, and obviously they were attacked in the media a year and a half after that on this sort of housing videos. Very interesting. In New York City, we had Acorn there had a canvas program that was going door to door talking to people about issues. Well, when all this stuff first broke and there was some video from the New York office itself, they... you know, did a training with the canvassers that first day and sent them out basically to, you know, answer people's questions about the video. Well, what they found is exactly, I mean, it's, you know, you can use this story in the future as well, but it's somewhat similar to the Nixon is a crook. Basically, when they all came in and they were just beaten to death, I mean, it was a terrible experience for the whole, the several crews that were out there. They were they were actually informing people of the problem.
Yeah.
So from then on, the next day, they just went with the same, you know, this is what Acorn is doing. Here's why we need your help. Here's why we need your participation, support, whatever the rap was. One out of 20 people would ever say, hey, you know, didn't I just hear something on the, you know, TV that y'all are involved in the mess? And then they'd respond to it. But before, when they were leading with that, they were just... you know, they were just, it was suicide on the doors. But because essentially you were inviting people to see Acorn as part of a scandal as opposed to seeing it as what it was and, you know, having people deal with whether or not they had a question or had heard about it, or in some ways you were educating people there was a problem.
No, I think that's right, and that would definitely be an example, a potential example of rhetoric that could be self-undermining, because even though on the one hand from the perspective of, and we see this a lot, you know, among in the academic world, and certainly when I talk to people who are, you know, very much involved with politics, is that, you know, they know a lot about what's going on, and everything about sort of, you know, the headlines in the news that day, and all the details behind them, they're experts on that, and frankly, they wouldn't be caught dead not knowing that stuff. But yet, for the average person who, you know, you might knock on their door and they're, you know, focused on something related to work or family or, you know, other sorts of, you know, religious commitments or whatever, they might not necessarily be focusing on this stuff and may not necessarily know all that much. And so it's interesting how, you know, you sort of still have a, the potential to sort of set the agenda in ways you might not realize. But you can also undermine that, that potential by setting it in ways you might not want to. That's exactly right.
So we saw something interesting happen in New York City in the mayor's election last time, where Bill de Blasio very aggressively put a message out of progressive change that most people, most pundits and others would have said, you know, whoa, that's a crazy strategy. But how, in terms of what you've looked at, did that work so well?
I think what's really interesting, again, is to compare the kinds of rhetoric that might lead people to support a candidate, to vote for them, to think that they're, you know, if you think about somebody who's in office, think that they're doing a good job, to believe that the political agenda should look one way versus the other. You know, we need to prioritize, you know, say unemployment over, you know, foreign policy concerns or whatever, those kinds of things. Not that, obviously not in the New York City election, but, you know, in national elections. I think, you know, the kind of rhetoric that might do that is potentially very different from that which, you know, might be optimal for getting people to become more active in other ways. And so to the extent that, you know, Blasio, I think this is exactly what he was doing, was responding to concerns that he knew that his voters or potential voters had. And that's potentially an extremely winning strategy. And we see this kind of over and over again, that people, candidates are very responsive to the issues that they think that the public, or at least certainly the public that might vote for them, care about. And then they, you know, try to talk about them also in ways that they think, you know, might appeal to that set of voters.
Well, and in his case, certainly a very effective way of dealing with the issue of fundamental economic insecurity that many New York City voters felt was to point out the sort of two New Yorks. So by, you know, metaphorically talking about, well, this is how one New York is being dealt with and this is how another, that message was not, you know, essentially sending, that he wasn't subverting his message and leading to inaction. He was giving people a sense that maybe by voting, by taking some action, even from the mayor's office, they could do something about that. And that left the opposition having to argue, what can a little mayor do about, you know, the huge gap of inequality, which, you know, New York is a poster child for. But fascinating. Professor Adam Seth Levine has written a book that we'd encourage people to take a look at. Certainly, if you're in the work or just in everyday life, you might want to start looking at listening closer to what you're trying to do and how it lines up with what you're saying. How can people get a copy of this book? Can I give them some information on that, if you would, Adam?
Sure. It's available pretty much wherever books are sold. I know I've seen it in Barnes & Noble bookstores, but certainly on many websites, both the large booksellers as well as the smaller booksellers. I've also heard reports of it being in some of the smaller, particularly either bookstores on college campuses or bookstores that are, you know, kind of local bookstores, to the extent that we have local bookstores left around the country. So online, on the big retailers, as well as in a bunch of certainly large cities around the country.
And it's published by?
Princeton University Press.
So I'm sure you can also go on the Princeton University Press website and find out how to get a copy. Certainly, if those who are electronically inclined, I got mine on Kindle and, you know, right through the good people. A drone delivered it to me from Amazon. So I know it's available there. And is there a way, if people have questions, they can contact you directly, Adam, or is that possible?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have a website. I guess the best way to reach me via my website is to go to the Cornell University Department of Government, and I'm listed on the faculty, and my email is right there, and I'm happy to receive email questions or inquiries.
We've been talking to Professor Adam Seth Levine about his book, American Insecurity, and the fact that if we're not careful, it leads to inaction, not action. Thank you very much for being on Wade's World, Professor. I was talking in New York City to the head of the Working Families Party, and I'm going to connect y'all together, because the more I described about your book, the more he felt like he needed to go get a copy and maybe talk to you as well. But this is going to be something you're going to hear a lot about in the political season over the next year. So we may have to get Professor Levine back with us to take a look 6 months from now at how the campaign's shaping and how these messages are developing. This is Wade Rathke. Next week on Wade's World, we're going to talk about the fight against coal and some work being done by some people, fascinatingly, about the cost of energy and why coal is going to be priced out, not just by the environmental campaigns, but also by market forces, if you can believe that. We're on www.kbf.org if you're live streaming, or 88.3. 100,000 watts of people power. See you next Friday. Thank you.